all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio. This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net.
I am your officer of the deck today, Lieutenant J.G. Type. We have two great programs for you today that I think you'll truly enjoy. I know I did in talking to these individuals. Before we get started on the interviews, though, we want to mention our sponsors, Legal Help for Veterans, a veterans disability law firm handling claims all around the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com. Our VSO sponsors include Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles S. Kettles Chapter, 310, in Ann Arbor, Michigan, American Legion Post 46 out of Ann Arbor, the VFW Graft O'Hara Post 423, and U.S. Wings, which provides those great giveaway leather bomber jackets. They've been online for decades now, and you can find them at uswings.com. We also want to encourage you to go to our website, veteransradio.net, and help us out with a few sponsorships, maybe some buddy money, maybe being involved in buying some of our new swag at the VeteransRadio.net swag store or PX or exchange. That also helps promote and keep this program on the air. And now to our interviews. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Professor Amy Rudenberg. Professor Rudenberg, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we have you on because of a certain research area that you work on and some expertise that you have, and a book that you wrote last year kind of brought this to our attention. But let me set this up. You're a professor at Iowa State University. You have a PhD from the University of Maryland, and you did some work at Harvard Graduate School of Education. And you find yourself with your research focus on the relationship among war, gender, militarization, and American society in the second half of the 20th century. That's a mouthful.
Yep. Yes, it is.
And you wrote a book that the title of is Rough Draft, but more importantly, the subtitle, if you will, is Cold War Military Manpower Policy and the Origins of Vietnam-Era Draft Resistance, that came out last year, published by Cornell University Press. So you have a lot of experience in thinking and writing and researching about the draft. And we're talking because in the last month, as a result of a drone strike and the killing of an Iranian commander, general, this whole issue of the draft and the selective service and how all this works kind of took over the internet, went viral for a few days or weeks about what do today's young people have to think about in terms of the draft? And so it made it into the New York Times and elsewhere about, will there be a draft? Does this mean we're going to World War III and there's going to be a draft? Well, let's back up a little bit.
I've always been interested in the question of what makes people serve. And I was a teacher outside of New York City at the time of 9/11, and it was a personal attack within my community, which lost members when the World Trade Center fell. I had students who went down and worked as EMTs at Ground Zero. And to my knowledge, no one, except with one exception, joined the military after graduation. And the one exception, he'd always wanted to fly military aircraft, even before 9/11, and that never wavered. And I sort of contrasted that in my head with what happened after Pearl Harbor, when the stories were about how recruitment stations had to stay open for 24 hours and the vast surge of people who joined up. And I was kind of vaguely curious about that. But when I began my PhD program, I had planned to look at women in the military. And I realized, though, in the process of trying to research that without understanding how men were recruited and how men ended up in the military, I couldn't really talk about women. I couldn't do a comparison. And that led me to the draft.
And you've written on this actually quite extensively, both in terms of the volunteer force that came after the draft, but also the draft and deferment policies and sort of the manpower policies during the Cold War and the Vietnam draft era. Talk to us, give us the short history of that so those veteran radio listeners who may be too young to remember the last draft have some context.
Draft was brought back to the United States in 1940. The United States has a long history of enacting conscription during times of conflict and then immediately ending it after the conflict ends and going back down to a much smaller standing force. So the conscription began again in 1940, and it continued with only one short 18-month break in 1947-48. Until the end of the Vietnam War in 1973. And so for most of the folks who lived after that point, I think they're aware of a draft during World War II, perhaps the Korean War, and then during Vietnam. But in fact, there was a draft that was active and in place through almost all of those years in between those wars. And so the reason for that, the reason that this was different from what had come before World War I is because of the Cold War, or sorry, World War II was because of the Cold War, where manpower requirements were higher than normal during peacetime, and where there was a worry that there could be a war at any moment, that with nuclear capability, there could be a very serious conflict, you know, at the push of a button. So the U.S. decided to keep a larger force in being, and to do that, they required, or they thought they required, conscription. In reality, except for during the Korean War and the Vietnam War, draft calls were very low. But the draft was kept in place primarily to pressure men into voluntarily enlisting. That if they enlisted voluntarily, they could have some choice over their branch of service and the type of job that they would have and actually the length of time they would be in. And so that sort of added control with the draft hanging over their head pushed men to enlist.
And in some regards, once the system was in place, it was easier to leave it in place because of the challenge of reinstituting it once they removed it. Wasn't that a little bit of the motivation?
Yeah, there was that fear. It also seemed to work. People today sort of at least vaguely, perhaps more, know that the draft during the Vietnam War was inequitable, that working class men tended to be drafted in greater numbers, that men of color were drafted out of proportion to their population in the population as a whole. But all of the pressures that created those inequities, they existed before the Vietnam War. They were part of a deferment structure that was put in place during the Cold War that was left there pretty much because the military didn't need anywhere close to all the men who were coming of age. This was the baby boom generation. They only needed a few, but they felt that keeping that draft in place, because it pressured some men to enlist, it kept manpower numbers up. And it was there in case there was ever an emergency.
Well, a good example of how, you know, there's sort of inertia, and once it's in place, you leave it alone because it's that inertia. It keeps rolling, I suppose, forward, is the draft has ended, and to reinstitute it would take, what, congressional and presidential action of some sort?
Yes. So what exists now is selective service. Registration with Selective Service was reinstituted for men at age 18 in 1980 under the Carter administration. But the Selective Service currently has no authority to actually conscript or draft anyone. So in order for that to happen, there would have to be a law passed, an act of Congress that would be signed by the president.
Well, and again, this is why it's back in the forefront. It's 40 years since registration started back in 1980. 40 years later, the stories, and I'm sure it's fueled by the internet in some regards, like, well, they can start drafting us tomorrow, you know, and this crashes the Selective Service site, as I understand it. But it's no longer a simple process to reinstitute the draft.
No, it wasn't even a simple process to reinstitute registration back in 1980. But I think the fear of young men comes today because they don't understand the system. So many just register with the Selective Service without giving it much thought when they, in many states, apply for driver's license, or if they apply for federal student loan aid, they check a box on the FAFSA form and don't really consider it or give it any thought. And so that general ignorance, I think, combined with a social media campaign that went viral in the wake of Soleimani's killing, it sparked a lot of fear.
Well, and you mentioned a word I want you to back up and talk about, which is manpower requirements, because today's volunteer army and the number of folks in it is drastically different. The manpower requirements are drastically different. So talk a little bit about what that means to maybe young men who have registered and whether or not they should have any fear about the draft being reinstituted.
Well, I think there are two things going on there. One of them is whether or not a draft actually would be reinstituted. And I think that there would be a lot of political pushback against that idea, regardless of what was happening in the world. And so long as the Vietnam generation is with us and their immediate memory is with us, I think that will be the case. But aside from that, if you think about what the purpose of a draft is, it's to raise manpower to fight a conflict or defend the nation. But the nature of the military today and how that fighting and how that defense takes place is very different than it was 50 or 75 years ago. So conscription brings in a lot of bodies to fill uniforms and do jobs. But those jobs, generally speaking, they require training, but not of the technical nature that so many positions today require, which means that the modern military much prefers a force that is voluntary, that wants to be there, that chooses to be there, and that is willing to put in the time to learn the job and learn what it takes in order to defend the nation effectively.
And this really goes to how much technology is now involved in today's military as compared to World War II, where it was grab a gun, learn how to march, and, you know, 100,000 guys are going forward at one time. We just don't see those kinds of military engagements anymore. But many countries, there are countries, I think it's 60 or so, that have a draft or conscription process. You know, it sounds more like North Korea, right? More like Russia or China, where we're just putting everybody in. It's a lot of uniforms. It's a lot of bodies. But it's not the type of military that the U.S. currently has set up.
Yeah, and also the U.S. is big and our population is large. If you look at a country like, for example, Israel, which is relatively small, it does have universal conscription, but it also faces existential threat from its neighbors. So the situation is significantly different from what the United States faces.
As you did your research and writing for Rough Draft, what sort of lessons did you learn that you hope the country learned or will have learned from that Vietnam-era draft?
So what I learned is that military service has been used and has been proposed to be used in all kinds of different ways other than national defense, or the way that national defense or national strength through military service are defined has been different at different points in time. So the draft has been used and military service has been used to, for example, offer job skills training or literacy training to those who might need it, or to try to better the economy of the United States, or offer citizenship training and patriotism and some sort of common idea about what citizenship is. And all of those are beneficial goals, but they aren't necessarily achievable within the structure of, say, universal military training or universal service. And that's left me pretty strongly feeling that manpower decisions should be made in light of the defense needs of the nation, how that's defined, and should, generally speaking, be separate from attempts at social engineering to try to make the population something that it is not currently.
And I think that social engineering that you mention has impacted all of those areas that, in terms of training and education, but it's also been in some ways viewed as, well, this is how we're going to get a bunch of folks from the South to meet a bunch of folks from the North or the West to the East, different racial ethnic groups. All of that has been part of that social engineering, I think, the military's engaged in at times.
Yes.
Did you find that?
Although it's, so plans for universal military training certainly talked about yanking the hyphen out of America. In other words, if you put all men into this common training, they're going to come into this great big melting pot and learn from each other and become Americans. But at the same time, those proposals were at a time when the military was segregated by race. So I think that there are the military, you know, this is civil military relations. It's a reflection of the society at large. It should reflect the society at large. That means that it is, in my opinion, the role of the military to reflect who we are. That means that it should be open to black people and white people and women and men and gay people and straight people and transgendered people and cis people. I think that there's room for that, and that in and of itself is not social engineering. It's when you try to wedge the population of the nation into a particular mold that there's room for trouble. I'm not sure if I'm expressing that as clearly as I'd like to be. So what you're not understanding, and I'll flesh it out a little bit.
That's a bit where the challenge is, right? If you have a universal draft, then everybody comes in, and you shouldn't get deferred for this, that, or the other thing. But that does walk you into the question of, are there segments of society that should not be considered for the draft, women, transgender, gays, whatever it might be. As you went through and looked at what sort of draft deferments were available and how they got used in the Vietnam era, did it teach you any lessons about, if you were going to reinstitute this, what would you do or not do about deferments? I didn't say they were going to be simple questions. It's a big question.
It's a very big question that has so many layers. I think we learned from the Vietnam War that privileging one social class over another is a very bad idea. So student deferments, certain kinds of occupational deferments, and this is one of the things that I found, that the occupational deferments that were most given by the time of the Vietnam War were ones that were very specifically designed to support educated middle-class folk, in theory, because these are the people you needed a college education in order to go into scientific and technical and engineering fields, and science was going to win the Cold War, right? We needed the next bomb, the next antibiotic, the next thing that was going to save us from communism. And so it became very class-based. That's not good.
And it pretty clearly. Yeah, and it almost seems like any rules you set up, somebody, maybe the lesson is, has been learned that somebody will figure out how to game the system.
I'm not sure that that it's possible to not have that problem. But at the same time, we need to ask ourselves conscientious objectors. What about selective conscientious objection? Honestly, these are big questions that were never settled to everyone's satisfaction during the Vietnam War. It's one of the reasons why the draft ended. These were questions that didn't have good answers, so let's just not ask them anymore. And that was part of the rationale for shifting to the all-volunteer force.
But isn't this the time for researchers and deep thinkers to say, what did we learn? And if we had to do this in the future, how would we handle these situations? What sort of policy recommendations would we make?
Well, as it happens, there is a congressionally appointed commission, the National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service, that has been asking these questions for a couple of years, and its report is due out in March. It will deliver its report to Congress, which will then be free to take or leave its recommendations. But there are questions that are going to have to be answered. What about women, for example? The Supreme Court's rationale for not including women in registration back in the early 80s was the fact that women were not eligible for most combat positions. But that is no longer true, so the Supreme Court's rationale no longer stands. There were also a couple of court opinions that came down quite recently that said that it was not fair to men to only ask men to register. So the question of women is looming. So if we maintain selective service, should women register? But then a different question is, do we even need it? We live in the age of the internet. We live in an age where people can be found if needed. And moreover, the Selective Service registration system as it exists now is a shell of itself. There are ways that young men exclude themselves from benefits like federal financial aid if they don't register. But no one's getting arrested. No one is sending the Selective Service changes of address when they move, for example, which is something that they're supposed to do. It's not a system that's functioning the way it was meant to in this moment. So I think Congress is going to have to take up the issue, and I imagine it will do so at some point after March 2020 when this report comes out.
Well, it's a very thorny big issue. So I
yes,
doubt anybody.
I don't envy the folks.
No, I don't. I doubt anybody will really touch it this year, being an election year. But it sort of comes on this whole discussion comes on the heels of this big worry or fear about the reinstitution of the draft and not understanding how that would happen, and sort of a discussion about, well, who is it who volunteers and who is it that fights? The New York Times just recently wrote on this as well, and really finding that, you know, a high percentage of people who volunteer are men and women who either come from the South or communities around military bases, and are more likely than not to be children of veterans and former service members. So this small group who volunteer for the military kind of gets tighter and more insular over time. And again, going back to the work that you did on the whole issue of the Vietnam draft resistance, how do you balance those two things? Maybe one was too large of a system. Is this too small of a system? Is there some middle ground that you see that should be at least talked about?
I wish I had all the answers. I think that we're still casting for them. Conscription, as it existed up until 1973, was inequitable. Military service under the volunteer system that we currently have is also inequitable. They're inequitable in slightly different ways, but they end up having similar effects in that people feel separated from military service in this nation. What the middle ground is, smarter people than me are working on this problem. I would say that it probably has something to do with understanding what the military is. I think that's why the research shows that it runs in families, because people who have family members understand the ins and outs, the benefits as well as the drawbacks of military service in a way that folks who don't have family members who serve, they don't see that as a full picture. I think another piece is probably our Are our leaders using our military effectively and ethically and respecting the service of the people who give it? Are people being put in harm's way for poor reasons? Are they being taken care of after they're discharged after they leave service? And those are a lot of big questions with, I think, a lot of room for improvement. And maybe that's part of the answer as well.
Well, we're talking to Professor Amy Rudenberg, who's at Iowa State University in the Department of History, who's written Rough Draft, Cold War Military Manpower Policy, and the Origins of Vietnam-Era Draft Resistance, to give us some thoughts on the draft today with a historical perspective because of the concerns that have popped up in the last month. But it really goes to this larger issue that also involves gender equity and how we use our military. I think you may have summed it up right, Amy, in saying that the draft itself back in the Vietnam era as applied was inequitable, but letting this become that a smaller and smaller group of people defend the United States with in the military is also inequitable, just in a different way. That might be the real answer here. And we look forward maybe to talking to you again back sometime after March when this big national report comes out to see if those smarter people than you, I don't think they are, but if those smarter people than you actually came up with any good ideas or whether they just kicked the can down the road. It'll be interesting to see, won't it?
Yes, it will. Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
Stick around after the news, and we're going to hear on that how that National Commission report came out and about the Selective Service.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Bosun's Mate Second Class Owen Hammersburg worked for hours to rescue two fellow divers trapped underwater. Details after this. When two fellow divers were hopelessly trapped in a cave-in of steel wreckage of an LST sunk in 40 feet of water and 20 feet of mud in Pearl Harbor, Hammersburg unhesitatingly went overboard to effect their rescue despite the certain hazard of additional cave-ins and the risk of fouling his lifeline on jagged pieces of steel embedded in the shifting sand. He reached the first of the trapped men, freed him from the wreckage, and working desperately in pitch-black darkness, finally effected his release from fouled lines, enabling him to reach the surface. Wearied, but undaunted after several hours of arduous labor, Hammersburg continued his struggle to save the second diver. Venturing still farther under the buried hulk, he held tenaciously to his purpose, reaching a place immediately above the other man, just as another cave-in occurred. A piece of heavy steel pinned him crosswise over his shipmate in a position that protected the man beneath from further injury, while placing the full brunt of terrific pressure on himself. Although he succumbed in agony 18 hours after he had gone to the aid of his fellow divers, Hammersburg effectively saved the lives of his two comrades.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We're now going to hear from Lieutenant Commander Eric Fritz, retired. He's a lecturer at the University of Michigan. He has a PhD, but he's also the state director for the Selective Service System and knowledgeable on the National Commission report that was issued that identified that Selective Service should register women. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio Eric Fritz. Dr. Fritz is a Navy veteran. He's an academic, but also out there working every day for veterans in a variety of roles. Eric, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks. Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with, we'll get this out of the way. You are an academic. I don't want people to turn off the phone or turn off the radio right now. We're going to talk about your veteran status and your service to the country, but you hold a master's from the University of Michigan, a master's in education and training from Southern Illinois University, and two PhDs from the University of Michigan, and you are a faculty lecturer at the University of Michigan. Tell us a little bit about your academic focus.
Sure. It's actually kind of funny because I'm not the classic academic, and I'm almost the opposite. I finished my dual PhD in 2010 and wasn't really anticipating working at the university. I got invited in on an emergency basis to do a lecture for them where they'd lost their lecturer on very short notice. So I stepped in on short notice, did quite well, enjoyed it, didn't think it was going to be a long-term gig, and they asked me to stay. And just consistently over the last 5 years, I've had an increasing role. I'm relatively unusual. Most lecturers teach one class at a time, in one place at a time, kind of just randomly. I actually teach in four different contracts in four different locations, including engineering, and I teach the core course of the entrepreneurship minor. So I do all teaching. I don't have any research lab or any research funding. I just purely focus on teaching and taking care of my students. So I'm not sort of the typical academic in that sense, but I do really enjoy being on the faculty at U of M. It's a wonderful institution.
Well, I know that those experiences have also recently led to you to have a number of assignments, if you will, overseas in this teaching role. Why don't you explain that a little bit?
Oh, sure. That's actually, it's not related directly to the teaching role, but it did involve some similar skill sets. I was recruited into basically people don't really know this, but at Michigan there is a consulting agency inside the University of Michigan whose job is roughly to take Michigan faculty expertise and share it with the world. It's called the William Davidson Institute. It's a wonderful institution staffed by some really brilliant folks. And they basically spend all their time trying to find ways to fit U of M expertise into requests for proposals and other grants that are addressing needs across the world. And so I was tapped specifically to help with a team that was in Turkey, and our job was to train Syrian refugees to be part of the Turkish economy. So basically you take these refugees, you teach them about entrepreneurship, you get them spun up on whatever their basic skill was, whether it was making a special kind of juice or desserts or just running a restaurant, and you'd help them with the entire process of starting a business in a foreign country with a different language and different rules. And basically the goal was, it's called gastro diplomacy, and we get these individuals up and running. We have one incubator in actually in Istanbul, and then we opened a second one down in Mersin, close to the Syrian border. I visited both multiple times and helped train the teams and work with the entrepreneurs. It's really very rewarding.
Well, you know, the Navy's slogan used to be join the Navy and see the world. But apparently you can go out and teach in the world as well. But let's transition to your Navy career. You retired as a lieutenant commander after 20 years of active and reserve service. Tell us a little bit about your Navy career.
Sure. Well, in a nutshell, you said 20 years. It was about half active duty and half reserve. I commissioned out of the University of Michigan in 1989 after 4 years in ROTC. I did seven, eight years active duty to start. Five of those years were on the USS Chosin, a CG-65, the newest and fanciest Aegis cruiser at the time. We deployed for Gulf War I right at the tail end of that. Then I came back and ran some schoolhouses for the Navy at Great Lakes. And unbeknownst to me at the time, running that schoolhouse was a real inflection point for me because my men were taking a part-time bachelor's degree in education from Southern Illinois University, and I went ahead and signed up to do the same thing because I'm a firm believer as a leader you have to keep up with your people and stay on the same page. So I just took this second bachelor's degree kind of just as a professional development exercise, and found out I really liked learning and education and training and research on that, and that led to a master's degree from SIU and then onward to full-time grad school work at University of Michigan. So the remainder of my reserve time was spent doing some random trips to, say, Korea for ultra-focused lens and things like that. But I spent, my unit was basically the Selective Service System. So it's a federal agency in the executive branch, and they use military reserve officers from all the branches to form their field force to maintain the draft infrastructure throughout the nation. So I did that for over 10 years, and then retired. And prior to retiring, I was mobilized two more times. So I went once to Bahrain, to do Pakistan earthquake relief and work, basically answer the phones from the Pentagon for a 3-star admiral. And then I also spent a year, that was a no-notice mobilization right as I was trying to defend my dissertation. I got sent to Iraq for a year, and I worked in Baghdad, boots on the ground, under fire with the 18th Airborne Corps of the Army. So I got to be the wayward Navy guy with the Army, in Baghdad, and that was an intense year. And that was basically how I closed out my career. So that was quite an adventure.
Well, I think many people can relate to having quite an adventure in their military career, and you certainly have. And it is funny sort of how one thing can lead to another, right? Who would have ever thought that an assignment that has you doing some training leads to a degree that leads to a whole new career field? And similarly, Eric, your time with the Selective Service while you were with the Navy Reserve led to an opportunity to be involved with the Selective Service here in Michigan. Why don't you tell us what you're currently doing there?
Sure, yeah. I mean, the structure is such that basically the field force is what's called reserve force officers, and these are officers from 01 to about 06, and they're organized in detachments, usually multiple detachments per state. And then there's a state director who is generally not military, is sometimes retired military, but never an active reservist. And that state director in the past was generally, they tended to use retired Army Guard generals and others like that, but that's shifted over the years. I worked for a number of generals as state directors when I was an RFO. And so I had done, like I said, I was well known within the agency. I'd done some good work for them and been a nationwide trainer for them and done some other work. I had gotten a call from the region headquarters saying, hey, could we just get you on a call real quick? We want to interview you for the state director position. And I was working full time at the university, and the nature of the call and the sort of the casualness of it, it really made me feel like I was kind of like the third guy on the roster filling out the interview schedule so they could say that they interviewed three people, but they had the person they were already going to hire, they already knew, you know, that sort of thing. And so I did the interview just fine. I took it seriously, but really thought that was the long and the short of it. And surprise, surprise, 2 months later, I was informed that the governor had appointed me as the new state director. And it's an interesting part-time federal job that I kind of stepped into accidentally. But it's wonderful. I'm happy to do it, and it really does fit well with all my prior experience. So it's sort of like being brought back to be the boss of a company that you spent a lot of time, building and creating everything in the company. So when you come back to be the boss, you're like, oh, I remember that. I remember how that works. I know all about that. So that's my role now, is to basically lead the same group of RFOs that I was once part of and supervise and manage the draft readiness for the whole state of Michigan.
Well, and we're going to come back to that a little bit and talk about the timeliness of that appointment in light of a recent National Commission report that was issued. But let me just wrap up one more thing that you're involved in so people understand sort of the scope and the breadth of your involvement in veteran issues, and that is your role in terms of chairman of the Veterans Community Action Team, or VCAT, as it's known here in the state of Michigan, for Region 9. Tell us a little bit about that activity.
Sure, yeah, because you've already touched on my three sort of jobs where they're the paid positions. I have a number of volunteer positions, and the VCAT one you mentioned is the most significant. If folks want to see the other stuff I do, you can definitely look me up on LinkedIn. I'm EB Fretz on there, but those are all the listed there. But I try to do as much as I can to help my fellow veteran brothers and sisters. VCAT is probably the biggest thing I do. Veteran Community Action Teams, there's 10 of them set up in the state of Michigan. They're an all-volunteer structure. We've been around for about 5 years. And our goal is within our six-state area to serve as a volunteer group that connects everyone who helps veterans, provides them resources, and gives them kind of a one-stop shop if they've got a veteran in crisis. And we've also, so we do like, you know, every other month we do a meeting in the different counties to bring information and resources out and build connections among those who help veterans. And then we focus on throwing these very large, this was something we've innovated here in our VCAT that's being copied statewide, I'm glad to see. We throw large social events that draw in thousands of veterans. We get sponsors to help us with that. And then at those big events, we bring in all of the service providers who are always desperate to connect with more veterans who need their services. So all these hundreds of service providers, be it the VA or equine therapy or some kind of, you know, outdoor, like Michigan Operation Outdoors, they do the outdoor hunting trips and stuff for veterans. They do, MyOFO, they do a great job. And so all of them are looking to have more veterans be aware of what they offer so they can basically serve more veterans. And that tremendous difficulty is connecting with them. So we provide this sort of magnet that pulls in thousands of veterans. And then at that same location, we cycle them through these tents full of these tables with these service providers that end up getting hundreds, if not thousands of individuals connected to benefits. It's a really great model and it's something that we're uniquely suited to do. It's something I'm quite proud of. I work with a fantastic volunteer team. Say my, you know, my sort of left hand, right hand man and woman would be Josh Parrish and Jessica Van Cleve. And we got another great group that assist in that volunteer effort. So it's a wonderful thing that we're doing and really putting some effort into the system to help veterans in the five counties around Washtenaw.
Well, I reached out to Lieutenant Commander Eric Fritz, retired, not because of all these great veteran things he's doing, but because of his involvement with the Selective Service System over time and his current role as state director. And Eric and I sit on a board together, and I know him to be a 100% fully engaged veteran advocate. So I wanted to talk to you about a report that was put out by the National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service. The final report was issued in March of 2020, called Inspired to Serve. And its goal, if you will, as a commission, was to talk about public service in general, military, national, public service, not just military service, but a broader service to the country, because I think most veterans view themselves as serving the country.
Sure.
And this report really talks on a broader basis about service to the country. Do you want to talk a little bit about the commission and what it was charged with and sort of the briefings that you've had on this over time?
Sure, absolutely. I'd be happy to do that. Yeah, I just recently spent some time speaking with National Director Benton, who gave his opinion on it and a review. I've actually reviewed both the executive summary and the 255-page actual report. For anyone who's listening who's interested, all of those documents are available at a website where the commission has set up called inspiretoserve.com. So again, that's inspire and then the number two and then the word serve, inspiretoserve.com. So you can find all of their work there. And the commission has worked for several years now. They were commissioned out of the Congress. They chose 11 citizens, not necessarily citizens off the street, but individuals of some note in different areas. They assembled a group of 11 to sort of run this process. They internally elected a president and certain officers and then handled their business over the last couple of years. And as you can see, if you look in the executive summary, there was really quite extensive. They had over 4,300 public comments, consulted over 500 organizations. They went to 42 cities and 22 states and had huge numbers of hearings and panelists and public meetings. So it was a very, very broad, wide, far-reaching, comprehensive review to see sort of what the actual man on the street and different organizations felt about all aspects of public service and national service. So what they really did focus on both military service, which is obviously the military branches and then NOAA and the public health service. And they also focused on public service, which is service within the government. So anyone who serves at any level, local, you know, municipal, state, federal, and then also national service, which is, you know, civilians participating in a non-governmental capacity, something like private for-profit organizations or non-profit organizations, that pursue and enhance the common good or take care of address needs in the different communities on a broad scale, which is the Peace Corps. And so we looked at all three of those and made a lot of great recommendations on sort of synergies in terms of pumping up and connecting all three of them. And within the military service, they then specifically did also address the Selective Service System as an agency and its role as sort of the fourth part of the National Defense sort of triad. It's just an extra insurance policy, if you will, to bring extra manpower, human power, if you will, to bear in the event of a serious emergency, military emergency, where the different services would find themselves short on manpower. So,
yeah, and I think it's important to let our veteran radio listeners know, we're talking to Dr. Eric Fritz, that this report did look at that broader service, whether it be the Peace Corps or AmeriCorps or Senior Corps, and I think there's probably a lot of sense, maybe it's just from older people, but a lot of sense that a couple of years of national service might be a good thing for young men and women as they move up. And I think that's part of what's expressed in this report, is how do we get people to realize that this is important? And give me your reaction to that concept, Eric.
Sure. Well, I think it's a great idea. I'd want to point out that the commission actually has set a very specific goal and said that their goal would be to see 5 million citizens per year by 2031. So 10 years from now, they'd like to see 5 million citizens per year pursuing some sort of involvement through military, public, or national service. And it's a very reachable goal. You know, you always have, say, about a million working thereabouts or more within the military. You have a lot of veterans. Public service is obviously a very large range. In some sense, the public sector is one of the larger employers, if not the largest employer in some states. And then national service, there are any number of them. So I think having something like that where through, without making it compulsory, but basically providing a really strong both economic incentive and then probably doing some messaging in the sense of sort of the John F. Kennedy sort of model of, you know, ask not what the country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. I think that levels of civic involvement, you know, have dropped. Involvement in civic organizations has definitely dropped precipitously. And I think having individuals serve and travel and sort of work for the common good and work alongside fellow citizens in different areas, a lot of research and a lot of, I think, practical experience that most of us have to say that that's really beneficial. I think there's a Mark Twain quote, you know, it goes something like, travel is absolutely fatal to prejudice and bigotry. And I think that's great. You know, getting out there and meeting others is a wonderful idea. So I'm very much a fan for public, national, and military service as a civic involvement, basically, for sure.
Well, and I think the report uses a quote that any definition of successful life must include service to others. And sure, I think that sort of sums it up, stated by President George H.W. Bush. In part of this is creating new culture, a culture of service, a culture that recognizes the value of it. This report, though, did take on one controversial subject in particular, and that is the concept of the military draft mechanism that we have in place and the expansion of that. Can you tell us a little bit about what the commission found?
Sure. Yeah, the commission made a number of specific recommendations for the Selective Service, all of which, except for one, the director is very much in favor of or ready to implement, and including the registering of women. But they did point out a couple of things. One, you know, they want to improve the overall awareness, because when we survey, something like only 50% of the young men in this country are aware that they're required to register for the draft at age 18. We've done a great job over the years of implementing what's called driver's license legislation, which allows us to kind of vacuum up names from the computer, and the young men and women, or just men at this point, are checking the box to say, yeah, go ahead and register me when I turn 18. So they don't even think about it at the time. So they end up in the database without ever having taken formal action. Now, back when I was young, you had to go to the post office, or you had to sign up, call on the phone and do this, or, you know, sign up online. Now it happens automatically. So we find very low awareness that a lot of the young men who are actually registered don't even know that they did and aren't aware of the requirement. So the awareness is relatively low. We want to bring that up. Also to exercise the system, since we haven't had an actual full exercise of the draft capabilities for a number of decades. One item they offered was to sort of remove the penalty for non-registration, which is a difficult one for us as a Selective Service, because if you remove the penalty for non-registration, you kind of make registration optional. And as it is now, it's required within 30 days of turning 18. And then if you don't register by the time you're 26, you face some restrictions on what kind of governmental benefits you can get. So you can't get student loans or federal jobs if you haven't registered properly for Selective Service. So this turns out to be a pretty serious thing. So we're really hoping to raise that awareness. And anyone who wants to know more about it can go to www.sss.gov. And you can also register there in just a minute or so is all it takes. But one of the specific things that they did mention, and it was the one that everybody was sort of wondering what they'll do with this political hot potato, was the idea that we would add the requirement of registration to have women register as well. The current requirement, as written in the law and approved by Congress, is that young men must register within 30 days of turning 18 to create a database of all available men. If we did need to be returning to conscription, we'd have a large database full of properly vetted, good data to make a fair an unbiased sample so that we could do a lottery and draft from that. And having that be ready and fairly done is key to having a valid system. And so that's one of the things, you know, that and maintaining the board members for any sort of hearings on judgmental classifications. Those are the two big things, really, that Selective Service does. So the registering of women would be able to occur if Congress were to direct Selective Service system to do that through legislation. And if that were to happen, then we would just simply register everyone who turned 18 as opposed to just men.
This sort of became controversial earlier in the year when they thought the current president would get everybody in a war on, I don't know what the latest issue was, but which country he was going to start the war with. But in any event, the idea that there would have to be reestablishing the draft and this whole idea that could the current Selective Service Commission actually gear up to do that? Because there is this sort of low awareness and the system hasn't been exercised. Is the data good enough to find folks if you need to find them?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, there's no issue with the database in present other than the fact that it contains only males. We have a nationwide compliance rates of at or above 90% for the 18 to 26 taken across the board. So for that entire year group, for that entire group of people, 18 to 26, we have a very high compliance and very high current data. I suppose you could argue that, you know, a lot of folks sign up from home and then go off to college. So a lot of draft notices will be showing up on parents' doorsteps rather than wherever the college kid is at. But we have good contact info for 90% of those that should be in the database are there. So in that sense, it's looking pretty good. And while the budget for the agency has sort of remained flatlined, although our current director was able to get some increases recently, so we have dropped in the terms of the number of personnel. For example, I have four or five individuals who work for me now in the state, and 20 years ago that was closer to 20 people. So there's fewer people, you know, so in doing more with less, we leverage electronic systems wherever we can, and we do a pretty good job with that. So if we were needed to mobilize, we would mobilize on a 193-day timeline. And so within 193 days, we would be able to send out draft notices and deliver individuals to MEPS for processing into the various military services as needed. So the system's there. I'm confident that it would work. I've been deep inside it for a number of years. It would obviously be better to have more personnel and a healthier budget for the Selective Service so that it would be more capable. And obviously it's one of those things that's sort of it's always better to have more resources than less, but it would work if called upon. And then the only real question now is, you know, sort of who are we registering? And there've been legal challenges over the years, starting all the way back in the 80s, Roscoe v. Goldberg and a couple of others. And that was the last Supreme Court one. And at the time, they deferred to Congress because women weren't allowed to serve in combat roles. But now all of those legal sort of defenses kind of have fallen by the wayside because we actually have opened up almost all of the combat roles to women. And so therefore, they're a perfectly eligible pool of potential service members and men and women. So if we do turn out to register them, it's not, you know, we'll need a little extra money to do it, but it's just more names in the database. So we're Selective Services ready and able to do the job. You know, we'd need a little extra funding because obviously that increases the load on our data management center and all those hardworking folks. But it would be no problem to do so, but it would be up to Congress and the president to put that law change into place.
Well, and I think that's what folks have to remember. It's not Selective Service who's going to make this decision. It's going to be Congress and the president. But it's absolutely worth looking at least the executive summary of Inspired to Serve by the National Commission. The final report on military, national, and public service came out in March of 2020. And we want to thank Lieutenant Commander Eric Fritz, retired, for coming in and sharing his expertise with the Selective Service System and thoughts on this particular report. Eric, we appreciate your time this afternoon.
Thanks. It's been my pleasure to be here and talk to you. And remember, easy way for more information is www.sss.gov. Thanks again.
Well, there you have it. Two interesting interviews with people who are very knowledgeable about the draft, Selective Service, the concept of registering women for the draft. We hope you found those interviews stimulating. That's part of what we always try to do here on Veterans Radio, is to bring you that kind of information. We'd encourage you to go to our website, veteransradio.net. You can send us suggestions for folks we ought to interview, topics we ought to cover. You can help us out by making comments on our Facebook page, veteransradio.net. And you can also help us out by going to our website, maybe buying some of the swag, the logo items that we have there, showing your support for Veterans Radio. Those contributions are used to keep us on the air all across the country. We're always working at expanding our podcasts and AM/FM reach. If you go to our podcast, we post a new podcast every Tuesday at 11 a.m. So if you want to hear something in between these shows, go to the podcast. You'll find the button there on veteransradio.net. We always have some very interesting people coming up to talk to, and I think you'll find it something to come back to regularly each week. We hope you have a great week. Stay home, stay safe. And until next time when Dale is back, you are dismissed.
WAAM Ann Arbor. Our First Amendment at work. Real public radio. Unbiased. Open and honest discussion.
24 hours a day.
WAAM Radio. WAAM.
Using veterans as...